Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. And become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome to Season 7, Episode 19. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing four spine-chilling tales for you, all of them from The Vespers Bell, about unsettling entertainment, paranormal puzzles, local legends, and houses of horror. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first two terrifying tales. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. And thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. Our first tale tonight, from The Vespers Bell, introduces us to a gentleman by the name of Nash, who, down on his luck, picks the absolutely worst house to rob. Without further ado, I present to you The Color of Television Tuned to a Dead Channel. Nash paused for a moment to look up from the unlit pothole-ridden street to the crumbling shell of an office building, towering over him, just to make sure he'd really seen it. And there it was again, a flicker of white and gray light from a window on the fifth floor, unmistakably recognizable as the comfortingly familiar and wholesome glow from a television. That didn't make any sense, though. That building had been one of the first to shut down when it became undeniable that his Rust Belt city's heyday was behind them. It hadn't had electricity since before Nash was born. Even if someone was just squatting or doing drugs up there, they wouldn't have brought up a whole television and power supply with them, would they? Nash glanced around to see if there was anyone else to see what he was seeing, but the street was deserted. He looked back up at the strobing, mesmerizing light, the only light on the entire building, and seemingly the only light within view at all. It was like a campfire burning on top of the highest point in all the realm, broadcasting its location to everyone for miles around. Not a smart thing to do, considering what a very unenchanting realm it was. Smart or not, something was making and powering that light, possibly something worth pawning. It was possible, probable even, that the people who put it up there were still around, and not at all unlikely that they might be dangerous. But Nash wasn't exactly a pushover either, and it was also just possible enough that the people watching that television were too starved or strung out to put up much of a fight. Reaching into his hoodie pocket and concealing his butterfly knife in the palm of his hand, Nash moved in to investigate. The building's front door was unlocked and, in fact, didn't seem capable of closing properly to begin with. Nash didn't risk giving away his own position with his phone light, and made his way using only what meager starlight managed to slip through the filthy windows. As difficult as it was to move quietly through a near-pitch-black building that he'd never been in before, he somehow managed to pull it off. He made his way to the nearest staircase and climbed up to the fifth floor. From there, it wasn't hard to find his quarry. The hallway he found himself in was illuminated by the same white and gray flashing light that he'd seen from below, only far brighter. It poured out of an open doorway less than halfway down the hall from where he was standing. He listened cautiously for a moment before approaching, but heard no sign of human life. Hugging close to the wall and creeping as silently as he was able, he made his way toward the beckoning light. He very slowly peeked his head into a doorway and saw a room completely devoid of human occupants. It was completely devoid of anything, actually, other than the television. It was a beauty, though, an old-fashioned box set that looked like it was from the 50s, though its apparent name of Inglorious Retrovision, trademark, indicated it may have been a recreation. It had a dark wooden exterior with a convex screen on top, speaker on the bottom, and a pair of dial controls. It even had a pair of rabbit ears for picking up extinct analog television signals. The screen was on, displaying nothing but static snow. And this was perplexing, however, since the television didn't appear to be plugged into anything. "What in the hell?" Nash murmured as he stood over the antique device, staring down at it in befuddlement. Without warning, the snow flickered for a few seconds before displaying a black-and-white title card accompanied by the speakers playing dramatic music. Nash took a step back in surprise before actually reading the screen. "Underage serial killers in my neighborhood? It's more likely than you think. A public service announcement from the Ophion Occult Order." Nash only had time to read it once before the title card was replaced with the black-and-white footage of a young man standing on a picturesque suburban street. He looked to be about 20 years old, with lean, feline features and slicked-back black hair. He wore a dark suit and held a lit cigarette in his hand. "Mothers, fathers, I'd like to speak with the little ones for a moment, if I may," the man said in a soft tone. Below him flashed the words, James Darling, Master Adderman, Planeswalker, confirm Demi Eldritch, but don't tell anybody. Hey there, Sportet. If you're anything like me when I was a boy, you probably can't wait to go out into the world and do your civic duty by depopulating it of a few undesirables. It's a fine thing to be sure, not to mention fun. But if you're young and unprepared, it can also be very risky. But you don't have to take my word for it. What the fuck is this shit? Nash asked with a bemused smirk, sitting down in front of the old television to watch the surreal show. The scene cut to an image of a young woman, the same age as the man, with the same feline features and dark hair, worn in pigtails, as if trying to project an air of innocence. She was in a 1950s dress, matching the overall feel of the show, though her face was less somber than the man's had been. She seemed elated, actually, almost expectantly so. "Mary, darling, do you remember why you started killing at such a young age?" the man's voice asked from off-screen. "Of course, James, darling. It made me feel wonderful," she answered chipperly. She held out a cigarette for him to light, to which he kindly obliged. As she took her first puff, the words, "Mary, darling, Mistress Adderman, Planeswalker, confirmed Demi Eldritch. Seriously, don't tell anyone. It's a secret," appeared at the bottom of the screen. "It's not easy being a little girl, you know. You feel so small, so helpless, so frightened, so dependent on those bigger than you, and yet always scared that the same size and strength you depend on might be used against you. I didn't like being scared. I wanted to be feared. I wanted to be the scariest thing walking on two legs so that I would never have to be afraid again." "And how did you go about doing that, Mary, darling?" the man asked. "With knives," the woman smiled. The scene cut to what looked like to be prepubescent Mary, slowly pulling out an artisanal butcher knife from a wooden block stuffed full of knives, staring at it with an ear-to-ear smile. "You remember what a beautiful set of knives Mommy had, don't you, James, darling?" "Of course I do, Mary, darling." "So many beautiful knives, and you weren't allowed to touch them because you were a boy. But I had to learn how to cook. That's all Mommy ever used them for, though, making us food. But every time I held those knives, I felt safe. Every time I cut or sliced something with them, especially meat, and especially when it was juicy, I felt powerful. So long as I was holding one of those, all it would take was one well-timed, well-placed thrust to end someone's life, no matter how much bigger they were. I know you understand how emboldening holding even a small knife can be." She said this last sentence, staring directly at the camera. Nash glanced down at the butterfly knife still in his hand, unable to suppress the unsettling thought that she had been addressing him directly. "But suppose they had a knife," the man proposed. "What then?" "Knives only empower those willing to use them for that purpose. Mommy proved that," the woman replied, her cheerful expression fading out slightly, momentarily distracted by some bitter memory. "But even if someone else did have a knife and was willing to use it, it wouldn't matter." "And why's that?" "Because nobody, and I mean nobody, handles a knife like me." She grinned. "I knew that if I had a knife with me at all times, I'd never need to be afraid. But Mommy would notice if any of her knives were missing, and she wouldn't have approved of me running around with them. So I had to get my own knife." The scene cut back to young Mary, this time gleefully looking over a glass display case of hunting and pocket knives, as happy as a kid in a candy store. "You were with me, I think, when I bought my first knife." "Yes, you definitely were, because I remember making you promise not to tell Mommy or Daddy that I had it. And, of course, you talked the salesman into selling it to me and keeping his mouth shut about it. You always were better with people than I was. It cost me $2 whole. 2 whole months of allowance money that I saved up and paid for all in quarters. But it was worth it. It was such a beautiful folding knife, perfect for keeping secret. I kept that knife on me at all times. I even slept with it, and no one was even the wiser. "And how long before you took your first life with it?" the man asked. The scene cut again to young Mary, this time repeatedly stabbing another young girl in the torso. Weeping and screaming, the girl begged for mercy as she impotently tried to fight back. Blood and bits of viscera soaked her dress and splattered onto a cackling Mary, whose eyes and smile beamed with psychotic manic delight at what she was doing. "Whoa! What the fuck? What the fuck? What the fuck?" Nash shouted as he crawled backward from the television and stumbled to his feet. "That's it, I'm out of here." He turned around, colliding with the now closed office door. "What the fuck?" he shouted again. He hadn't closed it, nor had he noticed if there even had been a door to close. He frantically turned the knob, but it was locked from the other side. He slammed the door with his shoulder, once, twice, 3 times, but it wouldn't break. He spun around with the intention of picking up the television and throwing it through the door. But he froze when he saw Mary staring at him from the other side of the screen, with an annoyed expression. She and James had paused their interview, but the footage was undeniably still playing. "We weren't done yet," she said, her tone firm and commanding. "Sit down, Ducky, and let us finish." Nash swallowed nervously but obeyed. He didn't know exactly what was going on, but he couldn't deny that Mary was clearly addressing him directly. And he was in no position to refuse her demands. Mary smiled as he sat down, then turned back to her twin. "You were saying, James, darling, how long was it before you used that knife to make your first kill?" he asked, the same scene replaying as before, this time Nash remaining still for its duration. "Not long, that's why I got it after all," she shrugged. "I never started with animals, you know. I started with people straight away, seeing people writhing in agony because of me, begging me for their pathetic lives, helpless as I end them with the final thrust of my knife. It's orgasmic." She repositioned her head slightly, making sure she was looking Nash right in the eye. "And addictive. I'm a binge killer, and I've gone up to 3 months in between binges. But my binges were wild, let me tell you. I've killed thousands of people in my lifetime for no other reason than I enjoy it, and they can't stop me. And I'm sure that's part of what our audience is a little confused about right now," the man interjected. "How can a little girl with a knife be so unstoppable?" Mary smiled widely and blushed, demurely averting her eyes from the camera. "It's because we had a secret playroom, you and I. When we wanted to, we could turn our closet door into a portal to get to it. We weren't just little kids in there. We were gods. It was a good place to hide stuff, too. Stuff like cigarettes or bodies. When the timing worked out, we'd lure people over to our house without anyone knowing, show them our playroom, and kill them there. We took who we could get, but we both liked killing girls the best. They just scream better. And back in those days, especially, they tended not to fight back much. That's how it was for the first few years. But eventually, the high rate of disappearances started attracting some undesirable attention that made us nervous. I didn't want to end up like Great Uncle Lawrence. Luckily, that's when you, clever boy, figured out how to change our playroom's portal to any door or hole we wanted. And the world was our oyster. Okay, what? Nash asked, rubbing his eyes that the retrovision seemed to be putting an unusual amount of strain on. I thought I walked in on some sort of snuff film, but now you're babbling about portals and pocket dimensions? I don't get it. What do you people want with me? It seems we have our first audience question, Mary darling. James said, how would you like to answer it? Mary again made direct eye contact with Nash, a wickedly eager grin spreading across her face. With a demonstration, she beamed. Without warning, she lunged forward, passing through the screen like it wasn't there. She grabbed Nash by the wrists, and before he could offer even a token display of resistance, she pulled him through the screen and onto the other side. There was no color there, on that side of the screen. All was black and white, but Nash was so confounded by what had just happened, he scarcely noticed. He took in his surroundings in a confused, frantic blur, trying to make sense of it. Above him, the entirety of the sky was overcast with the same static snow he had first seen on the retrovision screen. Only now the ever-shifting black-and-white dots formed the most unsettling and repugnant patterns if he gazed at them for any length of time. Around him was a neighborhood of identical houses with identical lawns and identical fences, either as a satire of the monotony of suburban planning or just a genuine lack of creativity on the part of its designers. Nash sincerely hoped it was the latter. Over him stood the darlings, James and Mary, looking exactly as they had on screen, cigarettes in their hand and a predatory sparkle in their eyes. "Stay back! Stay back!" Nash screamed as he wildly waved his butterfly knife through the air. The twins exchanged smug glances at one another. "You want to take this one, James, darling?" Mary asked politely. "I did make a bit of a pig out of myself on the last hunt." "Already forgiven, Mary, darling," James assured her. "Besides, we've been the star of this little document of ours so far. It would be a terrible creative decision to shift focus now." Mary smiled, sharply turning her head towards Nash, her gaze steely and shark-like. "You call that a knife?" she asked quietly. "This is a knife." She pulled out a 10-inch butcher knife with a clip point from the sash of her dress. With a well-honed aim, she threw the knife, impaling the palm of Nash's right hand with it. Dropping his own blade, he screamed in agony, clutching his injured appendage as close to his chest as he could, without impaling himself further. "You're welcome," Mary said. She held out her right hand, and the fallen butterfly knife flew into it as if her possession of the blade was an inviolable law of physics in this world. "Remember what I said about knives only empowering those who are willing to use them for that purpose? You've got a knife now, a proper knife. So if you can't use it to protect yourself, that's your own fault." "You fucking psycho bitch!" Nash wailed, crimson blood dripping onto the monocolored ground below him. Mary took a deep inhalation, savoring the scent of it. "Oh, so beautiful. Too beautiful not to show in all its glorious technicolor," she mused. "You've got two options here, Rambo. Fight or flight. If you pick flight, I'll give you a head start of 30 Mississippis, starting now." "One Mississippi, two Mississippi, three Mississippi." With a sharp cry, Nash pulled the butcher knife free of his hand, letting it fall to the ground as he tried to stem the flow of blood. Mary was still counting, her voice taking on a notable tone of irritation at Nash's casual disregard for such a lovely knife. He wanted to punch her, to beat her into a bloody stain on the pavement. He really did, but some primal instinct told him that Mary was not wholly human, and that his best chance for survival was to run and hide. So he did, leaving the only weapon he had behind. Mary stopped counting. She and her brother glared down at the abandoned knife with disdain. Very poor tactical decision on his part, James said with a shake of his head. That's going to cost him. Severely, Mary growled, breaking into a sprint and snatching up the knife as she chased after her prey. As Nash ran, he dripped a trail of blood behind him, its brilliant, vibrant redness amidst the otherwise grayscale world creating an all-too-obvious path for his tormentor to follow. He didn't bother trying to break into any of the houses. Even if they were locked, Mary would just follow the blood and he'd be trapped. so he just ran. He didn't know what else to do. He kept his head pointed forward, not daring to look up at the abominable sky. When he heard the sound of Mary's feet pounding against the pavement as she chased after him, he didn't look back. His eyes glanced side to side just enough to see that the houses he ran past were not vacant. Forlorn, barely discernible silhouettes stood in the windows, observing the outside spectacle with a fatalistic but morbid curiosity. When he dared to stare at them for more than an instant, he saw that they were made from the same television static as the sky. That static seemed to be setting in like a fog now, obscuring everything around him, growing thicker and thicker by the second. He could feel it as a tingling on his skin, and hear it as a buzzing in his ears. Worst of all, there was no avoiding the patterns now. The patterns in the snow formed a mutating Rorschach test of impossible alien shapes. Before his eyes, an incomprehensible whispering in his ears. They weren't threatening in the way that Mary was threatening, but through the mere act of being, they implied an existential horror far greater than being slaughtered like a lamb. The static itself soon overwhelmed his senses, blinding and deafening and numbing him to all else. The dread sapped his limbs of their strength, sickened him so horribly that he began to vomit. He didn't even know if he was still running anymore, or if he had fallen to the ground, but he did have a vague awareness that he was weeping and screaming, desperately trying to block out the static. He was only snapped back to reality by the sensation of Mary's butcher knife carving into him. Technical difficulties. Please stand by. Well, boys and girls, I hope you all learned something today. Sure, hunting your fellow man for sport can be a hoot, but it can also be downright dangerous. Mary and I were fortunate to have a secure killing ground in Larder, but many of you probably aren't so lucky, and I certainly hope none of you are lucky enough to have a pet Vagathost to fall back on if you find yourself in a tight spot. Remember, if your quarry gets away or someone finds their bodies, you'll get caught, and then it's game over, bucko. It's best to wait until you're old enough to be licensed and registered, 18 to 22 depending on your jurisdiction, so that you can kill safely and sustainably. I know that may seem like a long time, but with a little patience, one day you'll be able to kill with the same skill, gratification, and impunity as Mary here. Mary laid naked upon the ground, at some point in her frenzy, having discarded her dress and taken the opportunity to bathe in Nash's blood. Nearly every inch of her was crimson now, her body the only patch of color amidst the gray that surrounded her. Her chest rose and fell as she panted heavily, her belly gorged with her favorite cuts of meat. The shredded remains of Nash's body were strewn about her in a haphazard manner. Mary, having done to his flesh what the thing in the static, the Vagathost, had done to his mind. She slowly raised the knife to her mouth and licked it clean, ruby rivulets dripping down her throat as she savored every last instance of her kill. Stay sanguine, America. Good night. James knelt down to his sister and extended a sweet martini garnished with a maraschino cherry. Thank you, James, darling, she said as she accepted the refreshment. Sorry about the mess. Should we clean it up before the next take? Let's leave it in. An Easter egg for the more eagle-eyed viewers, like the Munchkin hanging himself in The Wizard of Oz. James smirked as he sipped an old-fashioned cocktail. Oh, looks like the Retrovision's got another bite. Is our leading lady ready for an encore? Can I do the whole interview like this, but just act like it's completely normal? She asked, excitedly, pulling the cherry off of its skewer with her teeth. It'll freak them out so much. A slow and sadistic grin spread across James' face. His naked, blood-spattered sister on the black-and-white retrovision was the most salacious idea they had in a while. I think a little splash of color is exactly what this production needs.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish, or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
I hope you enjoyed The Color of Television, Tuned to a Dead Channel, as written by the Vespers Bell and performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that first tale and would love to read and hear more from tonight's very talented feature author, you can help support him by picking up a copy of his latest book, a collection of 24 incredible stories entitled The Heroic Chronicles, Volume 1, available now on Amazon. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com/Vesper. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Vesper, spelled V-E-S-P-E-R, and you'll be redirected to the author's profile on our horror fiction website, creepypastastories.com, where you can learn more about this talented gentleman or connect with him via his official subreddit, and find a convenient link to Amazon where you can buy his book today. As an Amazon associate, a portion of your purchase made via clicking that link, by the way, comes back to us to help support this show as well as the author. The Heroic Chronicles, Volume 1, was just released this past October and features two dozen of Vesper Bell's best works, including his critically acclaimed seven-part series, Hallowed Ground. In the more than 400 pages worth of content in the book, you'll explore the bizarre and the unbelievable, recounting more paranormal and petrifying adventures from the borders of Heroic County and beyond. From serial killer siblings to cerebrospinal psychopaths to unseen specters spun from the primeval darkness itself, you won't regret getting a copy today. Purchase your copy of The Heroic Chronicles today at simplyscarypodcast.com/Vesper and click Amazon or the image of the book's cover further down the page. You won't be sorry you did. And when you do, be sure to leave a 5-star review and a kind word and let the author know you heard about him here on this show. Thanks again for your support of this show and of tonight's featured author. Up next, we've got a second tale of terror for you, courtesy, once again, of the Vespers Bell. In it, we'll meet Charisse, a young woman who's found herself trapped in a strange place. Will she find a way out before it's too late? Only time will tell. Stay tuned. Without further ado, I present to you The Worst Thing in the World. Charisse's high-heeled boots clicked more heavily than usual against the marble tile of the Avalon View Luxury Apartments lobby, as she was weighted down by several bags of groceries. She wasn't accustomed to doing her own food shopping, but the service she normally used had recently been prioritizing clients who were either housebound or immunocompromised, leaving her high and dry. Ordering online proved hit and miss at best, and eventually she accepted that if she wanted her groceries on time and to order, she'd have to do it herself. Unfortunately, that didn't work out either. The long lines at both the entrance and the cashiers kept her well behind schedule, and the various supply shortages and rationing left her shopping list once again incomplete. By the time she got back to her building, she was exhausted and frustrated, and sorely hoped that the earlier maintenance to the elevators had been finished so she wouldn't have to drag her meager yet hard-won haul up 7 flights of stairs. Across the lobby, she spotted a single elevator with its doors open to a golden Art Deco interior, a surprising upgrade from the faux wood paneling it had before. Standing at its threshold was a smiling, handsome young man, dressed in a deep crimson uniform with gold accents. He looked like a doorman or bellhop straight out of the 1920s, the only visible anachronism being a face shield clipped to the brim of his cap. He waved her over with a hand clad in an immaculate white glove, assuring her that the elevator was fully operational. "Evening, ma'am. Needing a lift? I'm James, and I'll be your lift attendant today," he greeted cheerfully. "Lift attendant?" Charisse asked with a bemused smirk. "Yes, ma'am. Mr. Chamberlain is employing us at all his properties now," James explained. "We eliminate public contact with the controls and enforce physical distancing while adding a bit of old-fashioned class and personal service to the experience. If you'll kindly take your place in one of the marked corners, ma'am, I can have you upstairs in a jiffy." Charisse stepped into the elevator, noting with no small amount of delight that it was illuminated by a miniature chandelier. 3 of its corners were each marked with unusually ornate silver decals, politely indicating where passengers should stand to maintain a safe distance from each other. 8th floor, please, James," she instructed as she set her bags down on the floor around her. He took his place next to an elaborate brass control box, covered with switches and dials and indicator lights, with a large lever sitting on top. He flipped a few switches and turned a few knobs, and when he finally seemed satisfied, he pushed a button to close the doors. "Going up," he announced, pushing the lever forward and initiating a smooth ascent. "That's quite a contraption," Charisse commented, eyeing it with a hint of derision. "What's it need to be so complicated for?" "It's a bit of kludge, ma'am. Tech from different eras all cobbled together, but it gets the job done," James replied while keeping his gaze focused intently on the readouts, the blinking indicator lights dimly illuminating his unblinking eyes. "And here we are. Would you like some assistance carrying your bags to your suite?" Nowhere in the elevator did it actually say they were on the 8th floor, but when the door slid open, the hallway looked as familiar as ever, so she decided to trust his judgment. "Not tonight, James, thank you. Perhaps another time when I'm better prepared to receive company." She smiled subtly, picking up her bags and heading into the hall. "I look forward to seeing you around the building, young man." "The feeling's mutual, ma'am. You have yourself a fantastic evening," he beamed, tipping his hat as the door slid shut. Charisse rounded the corner and set the bags down again by what she thought was her door as she inserted her keys into the lock, only for the door to stubbornly refuse to open. She frowned, pulling out the key to make sure it was the correct one. When she saw that it was, she tried again, only for the door to remain locked. Had James dropped her off on the wrong floor after all? Her first thought was to check the room number, only to see that the small bronze placard beneath the peephole was completely blank. She furrowed her brow in confusion, turning her head to check the door across the hall. It, too, bore a completely blank placard. It didn't make any sense. She wondered if it was some sort of maintenance error or perhaps some petty spree of vandalism. But if her apartment key wouldn't work, that meant that she was either on the wrong floor or that the superintendent had changed the lock. Groaning in frustration and with burdensome bags of groceries still in tow, she spun around to head back to the elevators in the hopes of finding out what floor she was on. When she turned the corner, she came to a dead stop. her frustration quickly morphing into fear at the impossible sight before her. Where the elevator lobby should have been, there was instead another hallway, a perfect duplicate of the hallway she'd just come from, and a hallway that by all logic shouldn't have existed. Even if she was on the wrong floor, the hall would have been stretching out onto Paladin Street, and elevators couldn't just disappear. Setting her groceries on the ground, she sprinted off down the hall to see what was on the other end. "Hello? Is anyone here? I think I'm lost!" she shouted as she ran, knocking on doors as she went. Not only did she receive no response, but every room she went by was deathly quiet. She could hear no voices or electronic media or humming appliances in any of them, as if they were all completely vacant. When she reached the intersection at the end, what she found was another identical hallway, with the same number of apartments, with no address numbers on their doors. At the end of that was another hallway, and another, and another. And then she realized she hadn't yet returned to her groceries. The halls all joined at 90-degree angles, so logically, there could only be four. But logically, the dimensions and location of the building wouldn't permit such a layout in the first place. She immediately began to backtrack, and sure enough, once she had gone back five halls, she found her groceries sitting exactly where she left them. She reached into her purse to grab her phone, only to find it had no Wi-Fi and no network connection. She dialed 911 again and again, but never got a signal. As the dread in her stomach slowly grew, and she felt a sudden spell of vertigo start to set in, she chose to sit down before she fell down. Breathing deeply, she forced herself to focus on analyzing the situation at hand. Somehow, she had stumbled into a series of hallways with no windows or exits, no connection to the outside world, and whose physical dimensions didn't appear to conform to her understanding of reality. It seemed surreal, and yet she was certain she wasn't dreaming. If nothing else, the fact the groceries remained where she had placed them proved this place obeyed some kind of internal consistency. She did her best to stay calm, reminding herself that she had supplies and thus plenty of time to figure something out. Standing up and taking a Sharpie out of her purse, she marked an X on the wall just above where she set her groceries. Taking off her heels and picking up a bag of groceries to take with her, she set off to map the hall system, numbering each intersection and pointing her way back to her base. After an hour, she had numbered her 100th hallway. In each hall, she would shout at least once and try at least one random door to see if it opened. No one ever answered, no door ever budged. No matter how far she went, she never came back upon any of the markings she had left, assuring her that in spite of their immaculate monotony, each hallway was unique. Each was unique yet identical unless you did something to change it, and devoid of anything that could be of any potential use to her. This was disheartening, as she had hoped to come across a fire extinguisher or any other blunt, heavy object that she might use to bludgeon the doors or walls with. She was considering accessing water through one of the pipes in the wall, but so far the labyrinth had given no sign that it had even held running water. In the full hour she had been wandering the hallways, she heard no noise other than those she made herself. No pipes, no air vents, nothing. Silence was starting to get to her. She couldn't remember being anywhere that was so still for so long. It was horrid enough being lost in an impossibly distorted version of her own apartment building, but feeling like she was the only living thing in such a seemingly vast space was unnerving, to say the least. Accepting that she wouldn't find anything, no matter how far she trekked on for, she relieved herself on the carpet and then headed back to her base camp. When she got back to the apartment, which she had first mistaken as her own, she took a large can of tomato sauce from her groceries and tried to knock the door handle off with it. The can dented and deformed and eventually broke open, spilling all over her hands and the floor, but the door handle didn't show so much as a scuff. Whatever this place was, it seemed its matter was every bit as unearthly as its space was. Seemingly infinite and indestructible, there was no conceivable means of escape. Cleaning off her hands as best she could with the materials she had, she moved her base camp down far enough so that she couldn't smell the tomato sauce, even though she could still smell it on herself, and did her best to sleep on the floor. As she struggled to fall asleep, she gave some thought to what could actually be happening to her. It all seemed real, even if it was impossible, and dreams were usually far less coherent and consistent than this place was. But if it was real, that meant that she wasn't anywhere in her reality. The phrase non-Euclidean geometry popped into her head as a, technically inaccurate, descriptor for spaces that didn't conform to known geometric models. At first, she didn't understand how she could have just waltzed into a non-Euclidean space, but quickly remembered the newly remodeled elevator, its peculiar control box, and James. She'd completely forgotten about that until now, the strangeness and desperation of her situation having been quite a distraction. But now that she thought about it, it couldn't have been a coincidence. It still sounded crazy, though. Someone converting her apartment building's elevator into some sort of space-bending contraption just to dump her into endlessly repeating halls? There seemed no point to it all. Eventually, she did fall asleep, and when she woke up, nothing had changed. Her phone was her only means of knowing any time had passed at all. She morbidly wondered if she could conserve the battery long enough for her to die of thirst. After eating some of her perishable groceries, she set off to explore in the opposite direction as she had the following day. Again, she numbered each hallway. 100, 200, 300, 4. Somewhere around 500, the combination of exhaustion, hopelessness, and lack of sensory stimulation took their toll, and she broke out into a frenzy of screaming and banging on doors as she ran through the halls, eventually collapsing into a sobbing mess. She stayed like that for a while, unsure of what else to do, until the unbearable silence was finally broken by the sound of faint music. Perking up her head, she had to strain to hear it, but it was there. It sounded like it was coming through a door around the corner. "Hey! Hey!" she shouted, leaping to her feet and breaking into a desperate sprint. As she drew closer, she could recognize the music as Frank Sinatra singing "That's Life" on vinyl. When she rounded the corner, it was apparent music was coming from the door at the end of the hall. She ran towards it with such fervor she nearly crashed into it. Unlike all the other thousands of doors she had walked past over the last few hours, this door had a number on its placard. Room 101, to be exact. It was further differentiated by a shiny brass door knocker with "The Darlings" engraved upon it. "Hello, hello! Is anyone in there? I need help!" Charisse pleaded as she banged on the knocker with her right hand and pounded on the door with her left. The music kept playing, but the feeling of hope was kindled within her with the sound of someone getting up from a chair and walking towards the door. She heard a deadbolt click, then the door opened as far as the chain lock would allow for. Through the slightly ajar door, Charisse saw a young woman with onyx black hair and baby blue eyes. She was wearing a vintage 1950s dress and had her hair in curled pigtails, which at any other time Charisse would surely have found at least a little strange. But now she was just overwhelmed with relief at having found another human being. "What's going on out here?" the young woman asked, her tone one of timid confusion. "Oh my God, thank you so much," Charisse sobbed, her voice cracking as she did so. "I've been trapped in these hallways since last night. They've been just going on forever, and none of the doors will open, and you're the only other person I've found since I got here." "Okay," the young woman said, her voice filled with uncertainty. I'm going to let you in so that you can calm down and we'll try to work out what's going on, all right? Yes, whatever you want. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Charisse agreed eagerly. The woman obviously didn't believe her story, which was fine with her. At the moment, she was no longer sure she hadn't just had some kind of psychotic breakdown. The door closed just enough for the woman to unlock it, then open it fully. I'm Mary, by the way. She introduced herself as she led Charisse to the sofa. Charisse, she answered as she sat down. All right, Charisse, I'm just going to make a phone call, then I'll get you some tea and we can talk. How's that sound? Mary smiled. Oh, lovely, thank you. Charisse nodded. Mary walked across the room, and Charisse heard the unmistakable sound of a rotary phone being dialed. She was surprised that someone who looked to be right in the gray zone between millennial and zoomer would even know how to operate such a device, let alone own one. When she combined the oddity with Mary's dress, the decor of the room, and Frank Sinatra still singing away on what was obviously a genuine 1950s record player, panic began to rise again in Charisse as an odd thought entered her mind. A crazy thought, but no crazier than being trapped in an endlessly repeating set of halls. She began frantically looking around the room for anything modern or something with a date on it. She spied a 50s-style pinup calendar on the back of the door, which, to her great relief, clearly said 2020 right next to the month. She sighed at the realization that this girl was just very dedicated to her decorating theme. For extra confirmation, she pulled out her phone to see if she could finally get a signal, and sure enough, there was a notification alerting her to the fact that password-encrypted Wi-Fi was available. There was no cell signal still, however, and that was definitely strange. She couldn't remember ever not having any reception in the building before. She glanced toward the open balcony doors to check on the weather for some possible explanation, which is when another unsettling realization struck her. The room number had been 101, and yet they clearly weren't on the ground floor. "Hello, darling. Yes, of course, it's Mary. How many other girls have this phone number?" "Uh-huh. Did she now?" Mary spoke into the phone receiver, cheerfully at first, but her voice taking on a noticeable edge as her eyes darted up towards Charisse. "Her name wouldn't have happened to be Charisse by any chance. Now, would it?" "Because she's here right now, darling. I found her pounding at our front door, scared out of her wits, and reeking of urine and tomato sauce, of all things. What on earth did you do to her? Wrong floor? That's all you have to say?" When Mary turned her back, Charisse rose from her seat and crept over to the balcony in hopes of finding a fire escape. She was too scared to try the halls again, but it was becoming clear that not all was right with Mary's apartment either. But when she looked out over the balcony, all she saw was a kaleidoscope effect of blue sky, white clouds, and myriad reflections of herself, all staring out with the same shocked and horrified expression on their faces. "Sorry about the sky, ducky. Maybe you should have come when I was better prepared to receive company," Mary said vehemently as she angrily stirred some sugar into her tea. Charisse turned around slowly, staring at the insidiously benign-looking woman across from her, in confounded terror, unsure even how to react. "What is this place?" she managed at last. "Room 101, she replied nonchalantly, casually sipping her tea. "You're reasonably well-read, aren't you, ducky? You know what's in room 101, right?" Mary smirked as Charisse bolted for the door, desperate for the hall she had longed to escape only moments ago. To Charisse's surprise, the door actually opened, except now the once grand hallway looked to be suffering from a century's worth of neglect and decay, covered in cobwebs and lit only by flickering lights that threatened to give out at any moment. This hallway also went on forever, with no turns or end in sight. As she ran, she could hear the doors creak open as she passed, but she didn't dare to look back to see what was emerging from those once inaccessible rooms. Over the pounding of her own heart and footfalls, she barely noticed that Frank Sinatra was still crooning away as loudly as ever. She screamed as she felt the ragged carpet being pulled out from under her, throwing her to the ground. She spun around to see Mary dragging the carpet towards her, and an enormous meat cleaver clenched in her psychotically grinning mouth, and an assortment of other suddenly terrifying kitchen knives held in the sash of her dress. Charisse rolled off the carpet and into the adjacent room, slamming the door shut and bolting the lock. It splintered and shook as Mary appeared to be using the meat cleaver as an axe to break through it. Charisse crab-walked away from it as she sobbed, desperately looking around for anything that she could use to fend off her attacker. She shrieked when she realized she was right in front of a rotting skeleton slumped up against the wall, a handgun pointed at its chin and a large exit wound at the top of its skull. She grabbed the gun with so much force that the corpse's hand disintegrated into tiny phalanges and metacarpals. With a trembling grip, she pointed the gun at the door, not knowing if it was loaded or would still fire even if it was. Mary thwacked and thwacked and thwacked until the door burst into shards. Charisse pulled the trigger and the gun successfully fired. She fired again and again, getting off a total of 8 rounds before the gun began clicking impotently. Shaking, her ears ringing and her vision clouded with gun smoke, she slowly lowered the gun to assess the damage. She expected to see the bullet-ridden corpse of her enemy lying in the hallway, but found no sign of Mary. She took a few tentative steps out into the hall, looking each way, only to find it deserted, but did notice a few splotches of blood leading away from her. Mary was still well enough to retreat, it seemed, but she was injured, and that, at least, brought Charisse some time. She turned around to search the apartment for anything else that might be of use, and saw a smiling and unharmed Mary blocking her way. "Boo!" she shouted as she brought the meat cleaver down on her skull. "Mary, darling, could you come here a moment, please?" James asked, a hint of displeasure in his voice. "Yes, James, darling," Mary asked, appearing from behind him the instant she was summoned, her hands innocently folded behind her back. "Would you kindly explain this?" James requested, gesturing to Charisse's mutilated corpse sprawled out on the lobby floor. The meat cleaver to the head hadn't quite done her in, and it looked like Mary had taken her time finishing her off. "Oh, right." Mary hung her head in shame. "I'm sorry, darling. I know I should have waited for you." "Then why didn't you? The rule is that when one of us lures a new plaything back home, we let them wander until we're both here and decide on what to do with them," James reminded her sternly. "But she started to break before you got back, and then it's no fun playing with broken toys," Mary explained. "So I let her into the safe room just to see if I could fix her up a bit before you got home. But I didn't know how much longer you'd be, so I thought I'd better call you and tell you to hurry back, and, well, that's when you said that she had been flirting with you." "I said she might have been flirting with me, and I was mostly teasing," James said with a shake of his head. "You can't tease me about that. You know how jealous I get," Mary said with gritted teeth. "Fine, fine. Mea culpa. Did you at least make it sporting?" "Of course, darling. I brought a knife to a gunfight. How much more sporting could I have made it?" "Just the one knife? That doesn't sound like you at all." James smirked and then frowned as he considered the implications. "And was it just her you killed? What about all the other playthings I picked up in the elevator?" "Well, you know how I get. Blood in the water and all that," she replied, hanging her head and kicking her shoes. "So, there are none left for me?" James asked as he threw his hands up in exasperation. "Mary, darling, if I didn't know you any better, Sometimes I'd swear you were a complete sociopath. I hope you enjoyed The Worst Thing in the World by The Vespers Bell, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed the tales you've heard tonight, I'd like to remind you one last time that tonight's featured author has an amazing collection of tales available for sale on Amazon.com entitled The Herowick Chronicles, Volume 1. The book contains more fantastic tales just like those you've heard tonight, with over 400 pages and 24 stories to whet your appetite for terror. You won't want to miss it, and you don't have to. Pick up your copy of The Herowick Chronicles by The Vespers Bell today from Amazon in either the paperback or Kindle editions. Just visit simplyscarypodcast.com/The Vesper, spelled V-E-S-P-E-R. Once more, that's simplyscarypodcast.com/Vesper, and you'll be redirected to our horror fiction website and the author's profile there, where you'll find a link to his Amazon page and the book itself, as well as ways to connect with him and send him a kind word. If you decide to give The Vespers Bell book a read, please consider leaving him a quality review and a kind word, and be sure to let him know you heard about him right here on this program and that Otis Gyre sent you. It would mean a lot to me. Thanks again for your support of this show and of tonight's featured author. Now, before we go, I would like to also take a moment to thank you personally for joining me for this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium, extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes, featuring twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs, or become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyre channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Story Time, dating back to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyre. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyre. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groshek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyre channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name, and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's OTIS at simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.